Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
A lot of traffic today.
You hearing
okay.
me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine. I'm not sure now, though, in order, because of what I had to do in order for us to hear each other, that I was actually being heard at all. So I think I'm just going to start over, and I'm glad that you got here.
Okay. So I'm calling from out of town. It's a little bit different than the usual way we've got the show running. My name is Debbie Brock. I am the founder of Homeopathy World Community, and I want to thank Alan for getting the show started today. He's attorney at law from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys, and he advises individuals, families, attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States on vaccine exemption and waiver rights. He also supports legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice. We're going to be talking today about a specific case that is in the docket now this month, and Alan is going to fill us in about Clover versus HHS, Health and Human Services, and how that will affect other people who have had vaccine injury at some time in their life and what kinds of things they need to do to get through the system. I want to thank our listeners, if anybody is there. I was not able to have internet access for a week and be able to post the broadcast for today. However, you can always listen to the archives and download it to your computer. We can do a blog about it, and you will learn a little bit more. So, Alan, I guess you want to get us started with the show today regarding this particular issue of concern.
Sure, Debbie. Just a little quick background. Clover versus HHS is a vaccine injury case and an appeal, and this concerns interpretation of language in the 1986 Vaccine Act that Congress enacted, creating the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. It's my understanding that to date, something on the order of about a quarter of applicants to this program or petitioners actually end up getting compensated. It's also my understanding that the FDA and CDC have both said that in recent years that something on the order of 90 to 99% of occurring adverse drug events don't get reported at all. The NVIC did a survey once suggesting that only 2.5% of pediatricians report vaccine injuries. So there's no telling. The compensation program may represent only a tiny fraction of actually occurring vaccine
right
death and
injury. There must be a lot of reasons why physicians are not reporting. One thing could be they are not aware of the relationship between the vaccine and the types of physical, emotional, mental changes that occur from a vaccine as a response from the human body. Maybe we don't even know all of the responses that could occur as a side effect, what we would call an injury that would be able to get compensation. So there might be a couple of reasons, and perhaps they just dismiss it because, for instance, in the case of my grandson, he had a vaccine and his entire leg swelled up into a hard red inflamed rock, and that was like that for a number of weeks, but my daughter just never reported it. So one thing is that the physicians may not even know. Another reason is they just dismiss it because fever is a typical response, and they say, oh, this is something you're going to expect to happen, these kinds of things. So that's why we may not have a full record, a database of injury cases.
There's also some politics going on as well, too, though. Doctors are, there was even a report that, a congressional report, testimony before Congress, that med school students are told not to report vaccine injuries. There's this belief that vaccines are necessary and you don't want to mess that up by actually raising the prospect that they also may be harmful. And so there's a lot of politics involved here. Of course, there's no way to measure that and virtually no way to really document it.
One of the things that you'll typically hear is, in order to get the good out of whatever the medical procedure is, you have to go through a certain amount of pain and suffering in order to get the total good of it. And I know that I've heard that very often.
Well, yeah, the theory being that whatever harm comes from vaccines, it's minimal and it's a necessary sacrifice that we as a society make for the wonderful protections we get from vaccines. Well, the problem, of course, is that with the tendency for both good faith and bad faith reasons to vastly underreport vaccine injury and death, we really have no available data from which to make a cost-benefit analysis. So anyone who tells you, well, you know, it's a necessary, it's a net
evil,
benefit.
Basically.
Yeah, necessary evil, and there's a net benefit. There's two profound issues with that. First of all, there's no data available from which to make that assessment. And second of all, even if there was, and even if the data said it's one in a million, now the available data shows it's significantly greater than that. But even if there were complete data available and it said one in a million, they can't tell you if you or your child, in the case of childhood immunizations, whether you are going to be that one in a million or not. And it raises a huge ethical issue. What is my obligation to take what we know is an unquantifiable and unknown risk, or require my child to take an unquantifiable or unknown risk, but nonetheless a very existent, I mean, you know, the $2 billion in claims, nobody can say anymore that vaccines, nobody can reasonably say that vaccines don't carry a risk of death and permanent disability. Clearly they do. The only debate is over what's the extent of that. And with there being any risk at all, there's, again, a huge ethical issue. Who has the right to tell you that you or your child has to take that risk, even if collectively there's a net benefit? I'm personally convinced that there probably isn't, but even more convinced that we really don't know. And even if we know nothing more than that we don't know, that we can't quantify it, then the government should not be in a position of requiring any of us to take an unknown, you know, risk of injury or death. If you want the vaccine, fine, and if you believe they work, and if they do work, then you'll get some protection from it. But of course, there are many other things. But let me reel myself back in anyway, Debbie, because I want to get through some points here. And as you know, when you and I get to talking, the hour goes away quickly. Dr. Kloer, Melissa Kloer, as medical doctor in 1996 and 1997, got three consecutive hepatitis B shots. And about a month after her third one, she started experiencing numbness, electric shock sensations. these are common symptoms associated with MS and other demyelinating diseases. But for her, over a period of years, the symptoms were fleeting and were really at most pre-multiple sclerosis. When I say MS, that's what I'm referring to, pre-MS symptoms. She didn't have an actual diagnosis of multiple sclerosis or MS until 2003. In 2004, she was able to get Social Security disability. And then in the September of 2004, she ran across an editorial and a prospective French study in the journal Neurology, which suggested to her a possible connection between the hepatitis B vaccines she had received and the MS that she had now fully developed. So she filed a claim with the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program in 2005. Now, this is the setup. These facts are the setup for the dispute that went through three or four different layers of hearings
system.
And appeals.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the court system. And the question centering around primarily the issue of, well, if she had symptoms starting in 1997, can she still file a claim several years later, maybe, what, 8 years or so later in 2005? And the issue specifically on that point centers around the statute of limitations. Well, I thought I'd take just a few moments to give a brief and very informal definition and description of what a statute of limitations is and why we have them in our legal system and how that works, because the primary issue in this case was that there's language in the Vaccine Injury Compensation Statute that says you have 3 years to file a claim. And this is somebody who was experiencing symptoms in 1997.
Hey, can I interrupt for one moment just for the setup of our radio show? Do you have a live chat on? The reason I ask you is because I tried telephone call was trying to come in.
Okay.
And it might have been telling us that people can or cannot hear us, and I wanted to check that people could hear us.
Okay, I don't see anybody on the chat except me. I'll type in.
Okay. I just wanted to check whether our sound is coming through, and I have no idea whether anybody can hear us. So we'll just keep going, and hopefully if anybody is listening, they'll go onto the live chat and let us know that the sound is coming through, that we're broadcasting.
Okay. Well,
And if the show doesn't work out, we'll just redo it again. Okay.
All right. Well, I have the two little red microphone buttons lit up, and
okay.
I was not able to hear you until I did that with both of us, and I had mistakenly
not
had that on when I started the show. So I think if we were...
Okay, we're good.
I think I was not being heard early in the show.
Okay.
I apologize to our listeners for that. Hopefully we can edit out the blank space at the beginning later for people who go back to listen to the show later.
Okay.
So, thank you for double-checking that. I am on the chat, and I don't see anyone else.
Okay.
Adding
let's
comments.
Just keep going.
Okay.
So she made a claim in 2005.
Right. Well, our legal system, state and federal legal systems, incorporate statutes of limitation for just about every claim. I think murder may be the only charge for which there's no, as a criminal charge, for which there's no statute of limitations. The statute of limitations is a period of time during which you have to file your claim. And if you do not file your claim during that period of time, then your claim is barred, or that is, you're not allowed to file your claim. Or if you file the claim, it gets dismissed because it's too late. And this is based on some general principles or concepts that after a certain amount of time, evidence begins to get stale or old, or people's memories of the facts, of course, is going to fade over time. And also the idea that someone who's a potential defendant, someone you would be filing a civil claim against, or if it's a crime that the state would be filing and pressing charges against a criminal defendant, that there should be some limit to the length of time that person is potentially on the hook. That for certain kinds of claims, for example, you should not be able to just wait 30 years and then all of a sudden file a claim against that person. So the duration of time for statute of limitations varies widely with different kinds of claims. But it's pretty common.
Can you give us any example of the types of claims? I mean, would it be something like a property claim on your home, or a rape assault, or, you know, what types of things have statute of limitations?
Well, I think just about every claim, civil or criminal, has some length of time, a statute of limitations, with the possible exception of murder charges. I think you can bring a murder charge against someone at any point. But probably just about every other kind of claim, civil or criminal, has a statute of limitations. So for most of us, most of the time, the question is not, is there a statute of limitations, but what is the statute of limitations? Well, it's my understanding, at least here in North Carolina, and probably this is general, it's real common for personal injury cases and other kinds of civil claims that fall under a large category called torts, for those to be in the range of, say, 1 to 3 or 4 years. And 3 years is a real common one. So I'm not at all surprised that the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program has a 3-year statute of limitations. That is very common with a lot of different kinds of claims. I know here in North Carolina, on the state level, if you have a defamation claim, you have a 1-year statute of limitations. That's the shortest one that I'm aware of off the top of my head. Certain kinds of contract claims will have either a 3 or 4 year statute of limitations, and so forth and so on. So it just depends on the kind of claim, and, of course, it's going to vary from state to state or from the state systems to the federal system. It's just up to each individual jurisdiction to decide what the statute of limitation is for what claims or what types of claims.
Specifically for the compensation, the vaccine compensation, is that what you're saying, for the statute of limitations?
The statute of limitations, the starting place for the analysis of this court case and our discussion today is that the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program has a 3-year statute of limitations. That is, from the time that the statute starts running, and then we'll come back to that point because that's key to this whole case and discussion. From the time that that statute of limitations starts running, the person who is injured has 3 years to file a claim. If they don't file a claim, then the claim is what they call time barred. So Dr. Clower first started having symptoms in 1997. She didn't file her claim until 2005. That's some, you know, 8 or so years later. And so it was predictable, I think, that the defendant in this case, the Department of Health and Human Services, is going to respond to that by saying, oh, this is past the 3-year statute of limitations and it's time barred. So the question then, of course, is what did Dr. Clower argue to say that, no, she was within the statute of limitations, so obviously as a starting place, she has to argue that that clock, if you will, the statute of limitations clock, didn't start running until some later period of time after her initial first symptom. Well, so there are a lot of different parts and pieces to this. She didn't actually get her diagnosis, though, for MS until 2003, so that was one of her arguments at one stage. So the case went up. The Vaccine Injury Compensation Program has its own vaccine court system separate and apart from all the other court systems. So there's a federal court system within what's called the Court of Claims that is specifically and solely for vaccine injury cases, and they have what's called a special master who is the function of judge in these cases. And this case went to a special master in the Court of Claims, and it was dismissed in 2008 as being untimely or having been past the statute of limitations. And Dr. Clower and her attorneys argued, they took it up on appeal to the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, and that panel, I believe it's a three-judge panel, but some subset of the total of eight judges that form the entire group of judges who hear and resolve cases at the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. But anyway, a panel reversed that and ruled in
This is a federal court, in federal court, not state court at this point.
Yeah, the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program is a federal court system, and so any appeal will be going up through the ladder in the federal court system.
And they reversed it?
Now, a panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit reversed the lower decision. They ruled in Dr. Kloher's favor. Well, the Department of Health and Human Services petitioned for what's called a rehearing on bank, which means they want all the judges to hear the case. Now, this is a little bit unusual for me. I will need to state, I suppose, up front here that my focus is on exemption and waivers. I don't do vaccine injury cases, but this was such an important case that I really felt compelled to come on the air today and discuss this. But they were able, usually if a court makes a ruling and you disagree with that court, your option is to see whether or not you can appeal to the next higher level, which for us at this point, a federal circuit court, I presume, would go to the U.S. Supreme Court. But apparently there's a procedure when a panel of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit rules in a case, they were able to petition for rehearing by the same court, but by the entire group of 12 judges rather than just a panel, a subset of that group. So that's sort of an anomaly to me in my more general understanding of how appeals systems work. But regardless, that was obviously an option. The panel of judges agreed to hear the case, and then they reversed the smaller panel's decision, and so that's the final step that we're at. Or the stage that we're at right now. I don't know whether or not this is being appealed to the Supreme Court. That's certainly a potential, an option that Dr. Kloher has, and if she does, there's something like a 3% chance statistically that the Supreme Court will take the case. There are very few, if any, and I don't really know the answer to this question, but few, if any, cases that the Supreme Court has to hear, but the Supreme Court decides which cases it's going to hear, and there are lots of people who want the Supreme Court to hear their case, and the vast majority of them, the Supreme Court says no. So I don't know if Dr. Kloher will be appealing to the Supreme Court, but this would potentially be one, I think, a legitimate case for the Supreme Court to hear, because we had a difference between the panel of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit and then the full bank of 12 judges. So
right,
the case
this,
has gone
this would be
back
a
and
mile,
forth.
This would be a milestone. This would be a pivotal decision if it went to the Supreme Court for the statute of limitations in vaccine compensation.
Well, this ruling, the current ruling by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is the law for vaccine injury cases unless and until the Supreme Court hears it and changes, you know, reverses the lower court. So,
okay.
I don't know if it's being petitioned to the Supreme Court or not, and if it is, I don't know if the Supreme Court will hear it, and if they do, we don't know what their ruling will be. So that's all very hypothetical future stuff at this point.
Right. Do you want to talk about what's called discovery? The person
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So the question then, you know, the pivotal question here, nobody disagrees that the statute of limitations is 3 years. The Act says that. The question is, when does the statute of limitations start ticking? Does it start when the person gets the vaccine? Does it start with the first symptom that somebody has from an injury? Does it start when the person knew or suspected they had a vaccine injury? Does it start when a doctor first proposes that as a diagnosis? There's any number of possible places, hypothetical places, where that clock might start running. And because of the particular ruling in this court, this latest ruling, As I'll explain in detail in a little bit here, there is a whole category of vaccine-injured people who are just precluded by definition from even being able to apply to the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And if you don't go through the program, then you can't, you're not able to sue in state court because you have to go through the system first to be able to do that. And with the Bruisewitz ruling that we talked about earlier this year, even if you get into the compensation system, if you're denied compensation, the prospect that you would have a case to take to court is very, very minimal, even if you do get into the system. But you have no chance, according to this latest ruling, to get into state court if you can't first get into the system. And so this is why this ruling is so disturbing to me and problematic.
So discovery is when the person is finally discovering that they have a qualifying vaccine injury, because, you know, this is time sensitive. Because if they have a vaccine and they have symptoms but they don't correlate it to the vaccine as an injury, they could go years before they actually realize it. In fact, the medical community themselves may not have actually made the link. So it would be even harder until time goes by, like this Dr. Clower realized only more recently from her investigation, research and reading, that there could be a link.
Well, I want to say, first of all, that the courts do not make, at least theoretically, do not make arbitrary decisions, that they look to precedent, legal precedent and other sources to guide them. And when they write a court opinion, they will cite these various other prior court cases or other information sources. For example, both the majority, the eight justices that were part of the majority and the four who were part of the dissent, it was an 8-4 decision, both sides referred to legal precedent. Both sides referred to congressional records, looking at what was Congress's intent. And they looked at records of congressional hearings on the Vaccine Injury Compensation the Act before it was enacted, when it was being debated and discussed. And what is I'm not sure what adjective to use here. I'll just say interesting and somewhat intriguing, I guess, is that they can look at the same cases sometimes or same information and come up with completely different interpretation of it. And that, to a large extent, appears to be what happened in this case. When you can do that, you know, logic is something we often attribute as being something that's sort of inherently objective. If you're being logical and you're using sound logic, that's not refutable. You know, it's irrefutable because it's logic.
Logic is objective based on the person who's thinking.
I think logic has an objective element or aspect to it, but its application is often highly subjective, and there's no, I think, better evidence of that than reading a court opinion where you see people looking at the same information and concluding, each one logically or presumably logically concluding.
It sounds like double talk, but you said it's a court opinion. If it's an opinion, is that subjective or objective?
Well, the arguments are worded in a way as to suggest that they're making an objective assessment. But my point is that there's obviously some element, a heavy element of subjectivity to it, when they can look at some of the same cases and same information and come to completely opposite conclusions. When you recognize that's the case, it's hard not to come away thinking that a court can really come to any decision it wants to. And there is some suggestion by some folks that some courts will decide where they're going to end up, and then they'll work backwards to put together their logic so that they can then rationalize the place they want to end up at. But my point is this. When you see courts, you know, come look at the same information and come up with opposite conclusions, it certainly suggests the possibility that a court can go anywhere they want to. If, and I have no idea what was going on in the individual judges' minds in this case, but if any one or more of them were thinking, stepping back and looking at this overall, what would be a reasonable outcome for this case? And is there a path that we can get there in terms of the legal precedent and other authoritative sources that is consistent with the, let's say, common sense outcome, even though people might disagree about what a common sense outcome would be. But some of the facts are undisputed, and some of the argument in the majority seems to be self-contradictory, and that concerns me when I see that, when they say one thing and then they rule in a way that seems to be, or rationalize in a way that seems to be inconsistent.
As if it doesn't come to the rational conclusion after reviewing the facts. I want to mention that Dr. Bob has sent me a chat message because the live chat does not seem to be working properly. It's possible you might want to re-click that chat to turn it on. And he has sent a message that indicates if a person is vaccine damaged to the point of actually dying, which does happen, we've got the Gardasil cases, at least a dozen of them, where someone has, those people have lost their lives, that could be considered murder, and if that's true, then there would not be a statute of limitation. That would be going back to the original concept of what we were talking about earlier. So I just wanted to throw that into the mix, and we can keep going. See if
that,
you can
that
get
what
that live.
Be, that
so
what that, might be considered murder? Because I was looking for...
Okay.
A button here on the chat to turn this on, and I apologize to listeners. This is usually something that Debbie handles, and she's out of town not handling that, so this is new for me, but I don't see my chat messages are posting. I don't see an on-off option here, but what is it that would potentially or hypothetically
right.
be considered
if,
murder?
If a person, and we have examples of the Gardasil vaccine, a dozen people have lost their lives, from a particular vaccine, that would be compensation vaccine injury. What he was indicating is people lose their lives from vaccine, which is tantamount to murder, and therefore there should not be a statute of limitation.
I certainly sympathize with the underlying feelings there. I'll say analytically that doesn't really make sense because for murder there has to be a deliberate intent to kill.
Okay.
You know, any crime requires, there are exceptions everywhere, but any crime generally requires criminal intent, the deliberate intent to have harm or injury result. We could certainly say at this point that people manufacturing vaccines and people who license them in the FDA and at least some of the people who administer them know that that's a possible consequence. But all of this at this point, and I wish
but
I could say otherwise, frankly,
intent.
But all this sits in a civil context where that wouldn't be. Again,
well,
I sympathize greatly with the underlying intent, though. But anyway, there's the real common standard in state personal injury cases, and as the dissent in this case points out, there are six sister circuit courts, as they refer to them. There are, I think, 13 numbered circuit courts, 11 of them covering various states geographically around the country, and then another one of those is probably this U.S. Court of Appeals Federal Circuit. But in any case, a real common rule that's applied is what you referred to a little bit earlier, W, the discovery rule, where the statute of limitations doesn't run until the person knows or should have known that they were injured or harmed or whatever, you know, the case applies to. And both the majority and the dissent refer to similar kinds of cases, medical malpractice and personal injury, for example. And so there was some arguing back and forth then in this opinion between the two different opinions as to whether let me start with the language. Let me just read the section, and this is what they split hairs over for several dozen pages in their combined arguments. This is the language we're talking about. The statute of limitations provides that if a vaccine-related injury occurred as a result of the administration of a vaccine, and then here's the key language, no petition may be filed for compensation under the program for injury after the expiration of 36 months after the date of the occurrence of the first symptom or manifestation of onset of such injury. So the key part is the very end there. The occurrence of the first symptom or manifestation of onset of such injury. So on one level, it was a fairly simplistic argument that the majority says, well, the first symptom or onset here was this symptom that she had after that third vaccine in 1997. So she had 3 years from that point. But if we apply here a typical discovery rule, we would, in effect, be adding to that, that this would require Dr. Clower to either know or that a reasonable person in her place, you know, would know. You can't just say flat out that somebody had to know, because then people who wouldn't know something that they really should have known could get away with things for years and years and years. And so, you know, you have to add in that sort of common sense piece that the person knew or should have known.
Plus you have to add in, not only is it the responsibility of the person to know, but if the medical community doesn't even know, they couldn't put the pieces of that puzzle together until later when we find out about it. Very often we have, right?
And that's a key piece to this, because from the majority's point of view, the symptom that years later she recognized could be related to the vaccine started happening a month after that third hepatitis B vaccine. And what the dissent says is, reads that language as saying, no, it's not the first onset of any symptom, period, but it's the first onset of a symptom of vaccine injury. And she didn't have any way of knowing that was a vaccine injury. Under the majority ruling, and Dr. Clower is, under this ruling, not allowed to, I mean, her case is dismissed. She has no opportunity to seek compensation under the program. And you're absolutely right. You know, she read a medical journal article in late 2004, and that was the first indication that she, even though she was a medical doctor herself, had any indication that this might have been a vaccine injury.
We need to qualify what is the first onset of symptoms, that not just any old symptom, but a symptom that the medical community acknowledges is related to the vaccine itself, because neither herself, who was experiencing the symptoms, she knew she had symptoms. That's not a question. What she didn't know was those symptoms were related to the vaccine. And so that leads us to the information about the table.
Right, and whether by medical diagnosis or any other source, if she could not reasonably know that the symptoms she had might be a vaccine injury, then on a common sense level, it doesn't make sense that clock should be running, because the way the court ruled in this case, the clock ran and the statute of limitations ran out not only before she actually knew, but quite reasonably, before she reasonably could have known. And that's sort of the key here. So yes, and that was my next point exactly, is that we need to make a distinction here between what the compensation program calls table injuries and non-table injuries, because Dr. Clower's injury was a non-table injury. So the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program has a table of very certain kinds of injuries that are considered by the medical community to be known injuries from vaccines. And so if you have an injury that's of a particular type and within a particular time frame that it falls on this table, then the vaccine is presumed to have caused the injury, and you're going to get compensated unless the Health and Human Services can show that there was something else other than the vaccine that caused it. But it's up to the Health and Human Services to counter that presumption. If you have a non-table injury, if you have an injury that does not meet the symptoms and timelines of the table, you can still get compensation, but if you're in that situation, you have to prove that the ultimately that the injury was caused by the vaccine. Now, in order to file a petition, you have to allege or claim certain things. And one of those things is you have to claim, of course, that the vaccine caused the injury. And you have to have some amount of information. You don't have to prove your case outright in the petition, but you have to include enough information to show that you have evidence and a reasonable belief that the vaccine caused the injury. Well,
right.
If
without
you're not
it
in the
sounds like without a question of a doubt that it's so obvious that they can't wiggle out of that.
Well, the point is that you don't want people filing frivolous complaints every time somebody gets
right.
hurt. You know, has an illness and they also happen to have been vaccinated at some point in their life. They're just going to file a complaint and you know you have to be able to argue. So you know you don't again you don't present all your evidence in a petition. You just make the allegations. But the statute requires you know minimum number of facts that kinds of facts that have to be alleged. You have to have either a medical expert or published medical studies. You have to have some medical authority, written or human being, to support your situation. Well, if you haven't, you know, if you've been seeing somebody for your symptoms and they're not able to diagnose, and they're a competent physician and they're not diagnosing this as a possible vaccine injury, how would you know that you had a vaccine injury or might have a vaccine injury? How would you know to be looking for that? How would you know to be looking for medical studies to connect the two to see if there are any? How would you know to be questioning different experts until you could find one who could answer the question for you or if there was a real good possibility who'd be willing to testify on your behalf and so forth? So, again, it comes up to this common sense standard that is applied in similar kinds of cases in state and federal courts, which is the discovery rule, when you knew or should have known. So the majority argues that it's unfair for people with table and non-table injuries to have different standards in terms of statute of limitations. Everybody should have the same standard. You have 3 years, that's it. And to me, that is just so contrary to common sense. The people who are the non-table injured parties
right.
have a much more difficult time of presenting and winning their case. And they're in a whole separate category. And to me, common sense would just dictate that for those people, there should be a discovery rule. And
mm-hmm.
And it ought to be, and it would be, not at all unfair, because the injury compensation program, the act creating that program, states as its purpose to make one of its primary purposes to make compensation easier than the conventional tort system, to be generous. And if you're telling people that they have to know something that they can't reasonably know and they have to file when they don't aren't in a position to have the information to know about that, and the time runs out before they reasonably have that opportunity. Because if she were able to take her case to a state court as a personal injury case, that discovery rule would very likely apply, and she would have a solid, sound case. So it doesn't make any sense to interpret an act whose goal is to make this easier than the conventional state tort system for it to
right.
make it harder to qualify, you know, to the statute of limitations. But the insanity doesn't quite end there. There's another piece to this. The act requires for petitioners in non-table injuries that they have to have sustained an injury. There has to be some sort of sustained symptomology or symptoms or what have you for a period of 6 months or more, presumably because they don't want somebody who had a temporary reaction to be trying to get money through the system. You know, that the system isn't really designed for temporary problems. It's designed for really serious. So they want you to have symptoms for 6 months or more. Now, I don't know if they're what the medical basis for that may be, if any, but it seems somewhat arbitrary. But the larger concept has some merit to it. They don't want small or somewhat frivolous cases in this system. They only want to be compensating serious injury. They have to draw a line somewhere. Dr. Clower's symptoms did not progress to a point where she had continuous 6 months of symptoms until after she was passed the statute of limitations that this ruling imposes. So she was not in a position to be able to file, as I understand this court opinion, until after the statute of limitations runs. That just doesn't make any sense. Again, what we see commonly in state and federal systems is that the action accrues, or that means you are now able to file your complaint or petition or whatever it is. And the statute of limitations usually starts to run at the same time. I mean, it doesn't make sense that your statute of limitations is going to come and go and you don't have the standing, as it's called, to file your case until after you've already passed the statute of limitations. I mean, that's just sort of defies common sense. And the best I can do trying to understand and argue the majority here is that they are trying to say, well, Congress clearly wanted to have this be a simple system, and by having this discovery rule, it makes it complex because you're going to have to look at this all on a case-by-case basis, at least for the non-table injuries. And there's going to be arguments about whether or not the person knew or should have known, and that's going to complicate the system. Well, okay. Yes, it will complicate the system, but the Act also said this was intended to be fair. Is that a complication that is necessary in order to be fair? Absolutely, in my opinion, if somebody is precluded from filing at all for circumstances beyond their control.
Right. If the purpose of the courts are to make judgments in cases for people to make appeals and make claims, then it may get a little bit complicated. I had two other thoughts before. I think our time is almost up today, that we can look at two different comparisons, one being the fact that pharmaceutical drugs are accepted by the FDA and given to thousands or if not millions of people, and then years later they find out, and that would be past the 3-year statute of limitations, that this drug has caused harm to a person's heart or a person's health or to a stroke or whatever it might be, and then they have to make a recall on a drug. So that's one example where you can see that the medical community does not have all of the facts before they start giving some sort of a pharmaceutical. The other thing would be an example of smoking and lung cancer, making a correlation between the harm of a different product that's acceptable in society and given, or even given for the reason of good health. Many of the commercials for smoking back decades ago would be, this is good for you to smoke. And so, therefore, we can see real-life examples in our own American United States history for reasons that would implicate we can go back and change the statute of limitations in particular situations.
Right. And so, again, I think you're just sort of underscoring my takeaway from this case is that it really just sort of defies common sense. I mean, the majority certainly had their rationale. They certainly pointed to cases to support their position, but it was not entirely consistent to me. And even if having the precise same standard for the statute of limitations for both table and non-table injuries simplifies things, and certainly Congress's intent was to simplify this over the state court system, that argument is valid up to a point. But I think that simplification at the expense of fairness, when both simplification and fairness were explicit goals stated in the Act, to me really is just working very, very hard. It's very strained to come up with that kind of a resolution, because it means it boils down to this now. And, you know, unless the Supreme Court hears and overturns this ruling, and if they do, only starting at that point. But in the meantime, and perhaps indefinitely, what this ruling means is that if you have a vaccine injury, whatever the symptom is, you have to file your case within 3 years from that first symptom. And they said a medically recognized system or system, you know, a symptom recognized by the medical community at large, you know, as a vaccine injury. Well, it certainly, again, the language was confusing to me in parts of this opinion, because it seemed to be sort of contradictory. Clearly, the medical community at large did not at that time acknowledge a hepatitis B vaccine, multiple sclerosis connection. I don't believe they do even now, although there have been hints of that, obviously, as Dr. Clower found in at least one medical journal. But she's, you know, you're not going to find that. I mean, the idea that people can be injured by a vaccine and because of one of two things, or both maybe, as in the case of Dr. Clower, that the development of the chronic illness that results is slow and progressive over time, and it takes more than 3 years for it to develop into a full-blown illness that can have a diagnosis so that you even know what the injury is, first of all. And then second of all, before it sustains, you know, for 6 months or more, to just categorically exclude any vaccine injury that takes a long time to develop seems to be directly contrary to the stated purposes of the Act, and certainly contrary to any common sense view of what would be the purpose of an Act. If you're going to compensate vaccine injuries, anybody who has a real, genuine vaccine injury ought to be able to be compensated unless they are irresponsible about not bringing their claim. Somebody says, yeah, I know I have a vaccine injury, or it's probably a vaccine injury, but, you know, I'm not going to mess with it. And then, you know, 8 years later, they decide, well, you know, I could really use some money. I think I will file a claim. You know, well, that kind of person, maybe they should be time barred. But for somebody who acts in good faith, they really ought to be able to file their claim. There really ought to be a discovery rule about when you knew or should have known that applies, even if that complicates the system for some non-table injuries, because that's what's fair. That's what is consistent with the larger purpose and intent of the compensation program. So I do find this ruling quite disturbing, because, again, it just categorically excludes some very real and legitimate vaccine injuries, and those people have no recourse if they can't, no other recourse that I'm aware of if they cannot get into the compensation system. Now, again, Dr. Clower got some disability benefits. That's probably a good thing. So she wasn't completely without any help for her situation, but to be categorically excluded.
Well, I wanted to just mention that the last minute, there's 1 minute to go, that, Alan, you have a fabulous ebook that people can get from the Homeopathy World Community website. On the right-hand column, there's a link to your ebook that gives you some initial background information about the legalities of waivers and exemptions for vaccine rights that people are interested in. And so I want to thank you so much for taking care of today's show for me, and I should be back home a regular schedule on next Thursday.
Well, Debbie, thank you so much, and I'm glad that we took the opportunity for me to learn a little bit about the system here. We'll be better prepared in the future, and I just remind folks that you are the founder of Homeopathy World Community. It is truly a world community. Debbie, you have done an amazing thing with Homeopathy World Community and bringing people around the world together with interests in homeopathy and related subjects. And I just can't praise you enough for the work you've done and you do, and for having the opportunity to be here with you every Thursday. And I'm really looking forward to next week.
Thank you so much. Okay, let's listen to you sing us out.
All right. Bye, folks.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate, before you vaccinate.
Your truth be unfurled one by one.